Speaking of family, my stepson, Garrett, Sally's son, older son, is now living in Vancouver, in Abbotsford. He loves the Fraser River Valley because he's a true mountain man. Like, he really is. And he loves the outdoors, he loves the camping, the hiking, and the fishing. And he's working for a landscaping company that builds commercial ponds. Because Gareth was a plumber's apprentice for 3 or 4 years, they really wanted him as part of their team, so he went out to work out that way. And they were at a building site this week, and I got a picture there, when all of a sudden, this stray dog comes up to Gareth. There he is, right there. Go back to the first picture there. That is the first? Okay, that's the first one. I don't know where this dog just comes on the work site, and immediately they form this bond. Gareth has always had dogs as part of his life. If you know Sally, Sally's a really big dog person. He's always usually had two dogs around him in the home. And so dogs have become a part of who he is, even though he's not always aware of it. And he started thinking that he might like to keep the dog, if possible. As they say, because dogs have been part of his life. And it would be a natural fit for his lifestyle, being mountain man meeting his dog companion. What could be a better connection, right? Now, how can you not love, well, maybe some of you aren't dog people, but if you are, anyway, a dog person. And Sally's warned me not to be too much on dogs, but because there's not, everybody's a dog person. But what a friendly face to meet. Next picture, and then the next one's probably a better one. Just to give you, that's the pond they're building, right? The commercial pond, yeah, in the background, right? And then the next is one more, I think the little, there it is, yeah, so. So I don't know if you noticed the first picture, actually, Gareth's in a digger. The dog's up in a digger with him, so. What makes this story particularly compelling to me? Because this is a pretty common story. People have stray dogs come into their life. There's nothing particularly unique enough about this. A good friend of mine years ago found a stray out in the middle of a hike that he was taking in the middle of nowhere, and this dog and him became inseparable companions. How the dog got out there, he'll never know. What makes this story particularly compelling to me is that the site where Gareth was working was a veterinarian's home. And they were building a pond at a vet's home. And Gareth ended up talking with the vet about the dog. And the vet said he'd liaison with the SPCA to see if there's any reports about the dog missing, do the chip check if there is one. He offered to house the dog in the meantime at his vet clinic for Gareth as they waited to find out more information. Now, what do you think the chances of that, do you suppose? A stray dog coming up to Gareth on a work site at the home of a veterinarian. Yes. Because Gareth works all over the lower mainland, around Vancouver, in the Vancouver area. He just happens to be at the vet, its home, when the dog shows up. And I take these kinds of events in life as signs. Do you? Yeah. I think they're meant to guide us in certain kinds of ways. When everything lines up properly, the right place and the right time, there's something powerful that happens in those moments. They're a guidepost for what we can do with our lives. Gareth was not looking for a dog. To be honest, he probably can't even really afford a dog. But when these moments come to us, these right moments, when the right place and the right time align, when they come together, they often point us in a new direction. A new thought emerges in our minds. A new doorway opens for us. A new pathway beckons us to follow. Now, a true skeptic would probably balk at my interpretation of this situation. The dog showing up to Gareth when he's working at the veterinarian's home was pure coincidence. Nothing more, nothing less. And yet, I think many of us have had these kinds of experiences when the right place and the right time align. And to attribute these events to mere coincidence seems an unsatisfactory explanation. Because I think we intuit the likelihood of something taking place. And we intuit in these kinds of situations like Gareth's dealing with as it being rather remote, unlikely that something like this would line up. So it begs for a different explanation. And what if these events in life came about not by random chance, but by an orchestration on the part of God? some higher minds at work behind the scenes. I think if we understood these as orchestrations of God, it would interpret our understanding of their significance for our lives and how we might want to respond to them. Did something happen in your life by chance, or was it by design? How you answer that has a big impact on how you're going to respond. Now, I think part of the dilemma for us is that our frame of reference is so small. Our vantage point is so tiny in life. We can't see far enough. We can't gather enough information to know for absolute certainty. So we're going to have to go in some ways on faith, either way, either decision we make. When I was a teenager around 16, I converted to Mormonism, became a Mormon. I was looking for something to ground my life. My home life was quite chaotic at the time. Mormonism is quite fundamentalistic. It's quite literalistic in its approach. So it gave me a very rock-solid foundation at that point in my life. And Mormons believe that there's a planet somewhere out in the galaxy that's called heaven. God lives on this planet so big that it takes 1,000 years to rotate around once. So that literally one day to God is 1,000 years to us as human beings. Mormons take the scripture in 2 Peter that with the Lord a day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years are like a day. They take that very literally. Mormons take it hyper-literally. They take it so literally that they believe God lives on a planet that rotates once every 1,000 earth years. And to be honest, it was beliefs like these and amongst other things that finally caused me to leave the Mormon church. I don't think so. I think it's pretty obvious to me that 2 Peter is saying that God's time and human time don't run on the same clock time. The point of the passage in 2 Peter is that God time and human time run on a different track. Now, life seems to me often is really about being at the right place at the right time. You can come to Trillium tomorrow afternoon. You can come and sit in exactly the same spot you're in at this very moment. You can be at the right place, but if you come at the wrong time, you're going to get a very different experience. If you come here Monday afternoon in church, you're going to find yourself sitting by yourself. No music, no preaching, no service, no worship. You'll miss out on the whole God experience that we come to celebrate here at Trillium. So being at the right place but at the wrong time, in some ways, is still being at the wrong place. We know we can get sometimes the event of a time wrong. And we arrive at a concert or some kind of family gathering. We got the time wrong and we missed it. Or we're late to it, to our disappointment. Time being as important as it is, you'd think we'd have a better understanding of what exactly it is, but did you know there's no scientific agreement about what time is? There's no working scientific definition on time. We don't know exactly what it is. We can measure it on a clock, yes, and we can measure gravity too. We all experience the impact of gravity upon us. We all feel the effect of time, but we don't know what gravity is. And we don't really know what time actually is. Timing is very important. Major League Baseball pitcher's effectiveness is based on timing. If a pitcher's timing is right on, he's unhittable. But if he's off, he struggles in his role. J.S. Bach said that playing music was easy. Just play the right notes at the right time. Really? Easy? Someone was meant to fly on a plane, but they got delayed and they missed their flight. That seems pretty unfortunate. But it turns out that that plane crashed and everyone died on the plane. And all of a sudden, what was unfortunate becomes a sign of fortune in their life. Did they miss the plane by chance or by design? What do you think? This happened to my uncle. He flew in the U.S. Air Force in World War II. He was flying back on a mission, and his plane took anti-aircraft fire. He was a gunner. He was exposed. He got shrapnel in his leg, and so he had to get an operation. And the next day, he's lying in his bed, convalescing, and he sees his crew taking off in their plane up for another mission, another bombing run, except the plane was shot down. All the crew died. He was the only one of the crew that survived because he was convalescing in a hospital bed. Timing's really important. It can be actually life or death. How many of you have ever come up to an intersection in the middle of winter when it's icy and you slid into the intersection? And had there been a car coming another way, you had an accident. But it was you were in the wrong place, but you had the right time with you. I think as we get older, we understand the effects of time. People come and go in life every day. We get born into a world, and we call it a birthday, a special day, and then one day we'll all be gone, all because of time. Time's impact is huge upon us, even if we don't understand exactly what it is. One moment, Jesus is there with his disciples, and the next moment, he's gone. Everything's changed in one moment. They are right, they are all at the right place, but now the time has changed, and he's gone. One moment, the disciples were expecting Jesus to restore Israel, and the next moment, he's simply gone up and away. Where did he go? The Mormons have an idea about it. I think they're completely wrong-headed about it. But they think he's gone to some planet out in some far reaches of our galaxy. But at least they try to answer the question, where did Jesus go? Where do you think Jesus went? What would you say about this? Luke says he was lifted up and then he disappeared, but to where? We would probably say that Jesus went to heaven, but where is heaven? Ancient people would have answered the question by pointing upwards to the sky. It's up there. If we could just go high enough, we could find our way into heaven. The whole story of the Tower of Babel in the book of Genesis is built around this understanding that heaven's somewhere above the firmaments of the earth. Today we know that if we kept going up, we would continue to go through space. Given enough time, we would cross the paths of planets, perhaps, comets, asteroids, maybe other stars, given enough time, and maybe even galaxies as we move through up through space into the full universe. But heaven would still elude us. So where exactly is heaven? And what is the ascension of Jesus all about? Where did he go? I remember reading a book years ago called Flatland. Any of you familiar with that book at all, Flatland? It was a little novel under 100 pages written in 1884 by a mathematician and theologian named Edwin Abbott. He lived during the Victorian age, and Abbott was trying to explain heaven to people who were consumed by a scientific, rationalistic worldview. How do we understand the concept of heaven as modern people? And he came up with a simple little story under 100 pages. One of the amazing things of the age of YouTube is that I don't have to try to explain Flatland to you. There's this beautiful little video that's already been put together about 5 minutes explaining Flatland. Far better than I ever could. It's got beautiful animations in it. The basic story and principles of Flatland are found in it. I'm going to show it to you. And now I hope you don't get afraid of being confused, because it's easy to get confused by these things. This is challenging for us. This is why Abbott wrote it as a story and not a bunch of mathematical equations. He wrote it as a story to try to explain to us what it means to believe in things like heaven. So I encourage you to stay as best you can in contact with the story. I think most of you will find it easy enough, but if you get confused, don't be afraid. We all will at some point be confused by what is being talked about here. So let's take a run at it. Make it nice and loud, Sam.
We live in a three-dimensional world where everything has length, width, and height. But what if our world were two-dimensional? We would be squashed down to occupy a single plane of existence, geometrically speaking, of course. And what would that world look and feel like? This is the premise of Edwin Abbott's 1884 novella, Flatland. Flatland is a fun mathematical thought experiment that follows the trials and tribulations of a square exposed to the third dimension. But what is a dimension anyway? For our purposes, a dimension is a direction, which we can picture as a line. For our direction to be a dimension, it has to be at right angles to all other dimensions. So a one-dimensional space is just a line. A two-dimensional space is defined by two perpendicular lines, which describe a flat plane, like a piece of paper. And a three-dimensional space adds a third perpendicular line, which gives us height and the world we're familiar with. So what about four dimensions, and five, and 11? Where do we put these new perpendicular lines? This is where Flatland can help us. Let's look at our square protagonist's world. Flatland is populated by geometric shapes ranging from isosceles triangles to equilateral triangles to squares, pentagons, hexagons, all the way up to circles. These shapes are all scurrying around a flat world, living their flat lives. They have a single eye on the front of their faces, and let's see what the world looks like from their perspective. What they see is essentially one dimension, a line. But in Abbott's Flatland, closer objects are brighter, and that's how they see depth. So a triangle looks different from a square, looks different from a circle, and so on. Their brains cannot comprehend the third dimension. In fact, they vehemently deny its existence because it's simply not part of their world or experience. But all they need, as it turns out, is a little boost. One day, a sphere shows up in Flatland to visit our square hero. Here's what it looks like when the sphere passes through Flatland from the square's perspective. And this blows his little square mind. Then, the sphere lifts the square into the third dimension, the height direction where no Flatlander has gone before, and shows him his world. From up here, the square can see everything, the shapes of buildings, all the precious gems hidden in the earth, and even the insides of his friends, which is probably pretty awkward. Once the hapless square comes to terms with the third dimension, he begs his host to help him visit the fourth and higher dimensions. But the sphere bristles at the mere suggestion of dimensions higher than three and exiles the square back to Flatland. Now, the sphere's indignation is understandable. The fourth dimension is very difficult to reconcile with our experience of the world. Short of being lifted into the fourth dimension by a visiting hypercube, we can't experience it. But we can get close. You'll recall that when the sphere first visited the second dimension, he looked like a series of circles that started as a point when he touched Flatland, grew bigger until he was halfway through, and then shrank smaller again. We can think of this visit as a series of 2D cross-sections of a 3D object. Well, we can do the same thing in the third dimension with a four-dimensional object. Let's say that a hypersphere is the 4D equivalent of a 3D sphere. When the 4D object passes through the third dimension, it'll look something like this. Let's look at one more way of representing a four-dimensional object. Let's say we have a point, a zero-dimensional shape. Now we extend it out 1 inch, and we have a one-dimensional line segment. Extend the whole line segment by 1 inch, and we get a 2D square. Take the whole square and extend it out 1 inch, and we get a 3D cube. You can see where we're going with this. Take the whole cube and extend it out 1 inch, this time perpendicular to all three existing directions, and we get a 4D hypercube, also called a tesseract. For all we know, there could be four-dimensional life forms somewhere out there, occasionally poking their heads into our bustling 3D world and wondering what all the fuss is about. In fact, there could be whole other four-dimensional worlds beyond our detection, hidden from us forever by the nature of our perception. Doesn't that blow your little spherical mind?
I love how the video ends, and I've got it on a slide there. That's what he says at the end in the video. He says, "For all we know, you need to move on to the next slide there. Okay, for all we know, there could be four-dimensional life forms somewhere out there occasionally poking their heads into our bustling 3D world and wondering what all the fuss is about. In fact, there could be whole other four-dimensional worlds beyond our detection, hidden from us forever by the nature of our perception. Doesn't that blow your little spherical mind?" If you think about it, there are four-dimensional beings in the Bible who occasionally poke their heads into our bustling 3D world. Do you know what they're called? What are they called? Sorry?
Angels.
Yeah. In the book Flatland, the sphere has an impossible time describing the third dimension to the square. It would be like trying to describe a new color beyond red or violet. How does one do that? There's no language really for it. The sphere says to the square that the third dimension is above you, it's up. But the square interprets that to mean further up the page, so to speak, northward. Because in two-dimensional speaking terms, that means going further along the page, and it's 3D equivalent. But of course, the sphere means off the page, not up the page, off the page, something the square can't even conceive of. There's this one scene in the story of Flatland where the sphere is outside the dimensions, the two dimensions that the square lives in, yet he has a conversation with the square. The square and the sphere are conversing, even though the square cannot see the sphere. And this perplexes the square. How can I have a conversation with something or someone I cannot see? In fact, the sphere ultimately cannot explain the third dimension to the square, as we saw in the video. He has to show him, so he lifts the square off the two-dimensional world into the third dimension. And for a moment, the square experiences a reality very different from his own. Now, Flatland was written by Edwin Abbott as an analogy for us. We who struggle in understanding the reality of God who lives above and beyond the three dimensions of our world, how can we come to understand the reality of a dimension beyond our perception? And Edwin Abbott says, through analogy. We who live in the three dimensions can understand someone struggling with understanding the third dimension from the point of view of the second dimension. And so he offers us the opportunity to, by analogy, say, well, now maybe we can, who live in the three dimensions, can understand and struggle with what it means to live in a world that has at least four dimensions. And if not to understand it, at least to have reasons to have faith in it, to trust it. When Jesus is taken up in Acts 1, understand he is not following a third dimension upwards. He's not going really up into the sky. And then out beyond the atmosphere to some distant planet called heaven. He's moving along a completely different tangent. He's moving along a new line to another dimension. We might call this new line the line of the fourth dimension. Who knows? Luke uses the language of above. Jesus went up and beyond the sight of the disciples. He went behind a cloud out of the sight of the disciples. But that's the only language Luke or any of us would have in trying to describe something beyond three dimensions. To describe Jesus being lifted up through three dimensions into four, that would be a challenge of our language that not even a gospel writer could overcome. How does one explain being lifted off the page of a three-dimensional world into a fourth? Jesus moved along a different tangent. He lives today in a multidimensional reality that's different from our own here. He's moved beyond our sense ability to detect. But Jesus is ever present, just beyond the tip of our perception. He's here. Just beyond the tip of your perception. This doesn't explain why Jesus left his three-dimensional creation, this three-dimensional creation of ours, in order to enter the fourth. We'll talk about that more next week, but I do want to say this, that Jesus came to draw all of us upwards into that fourth-dimensional life, into a four-dimensional way of living, not rule over us as three-dimensional creatures. Jesus came to teach us how to live along a different tangent in life. That's the only really way you can understand his teachings for us. He's come not to give us the best possible third-dimensional life, but rather calls us to set out on a different plane, to live from a different plane, to live and embrace God's, we might call, fourth-dimensional way of living. We still have our limits in our 3D perception, so we have to go by faith. Someday, Paul says to us that we'll have an immediate experience of what it means to live as four-dimensional creatures in the fourth dimension completely present to us. Today, it means we have to trust the reality of the fourth dimension, even if our perceptual limitations keep it hidden from our immediate view. What's going on with Gareth and his dog? What's going on between Gareth and the dog? What aspects of their relationship live at a higher level of dimension? Live it at a higher dimension that neither of them fully understand. They can, neither Gareth as a person or the dog can grasp, but they both sense it, each in their own unique ways. Sometimes we only have our intuition to guide us, a kind of radar to the presence of the fourth dimension in life, a sense that something's happening beyond our perceptual ability to understand. We feel a connection to something or someone, a time and a place line up. We cannot fully explain it, yet it's there to be experienced. We speak about the heart. Our hearts can speak loudly to us in life, but we're not really speaking about a physical organ which lives in a three-dimensional world of form. We're speaking about a different dimension of life, a tangent that reaches so deep inside of us to the very essence of what we are, about a way of life that moves us along a different dimensional line. The Lord wants us to follow the way of love. But I think if we're honest, love is a rather indefinite thing like time or gravity. We feel its effect, but it belies a simple explanation for us. Today, we don't even have a scientific explanation of love either. And often, love's pure presence eludes us. And it may be because love lives fully only in the fourth dimension of life, not in the third. All mystics agree that there's an immense love out there waiting for us. Just beyond our sense perception, there is a love waiting for you and for me. We just need to be lifted up into it in order to know it directly, powerfully, personally. The scripture says the Lord is close to us, that he knows us better than we know ourselves. As I say, Jesus didn't come to live as a kingly tyrant over us, but to guide us into a new way of life, to lift us up from the realm of this world into a new order of existence. He's come to elevate us into that new plane, moving us from one reality to another. Because he's already right beside us. He's right beside you and me in his fourth dimensional way, ready to get us moving. And the only question is, will we allow him to move us from a three-dimensional point of view to a fourth? Will we surrender our need to understand completely in order to allow him to guide us into the world that waits for us, beyond our sense perception, yet right in front of us in this moment?